Welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday, 15th of March, with me, Ian Welsh. We've not talked much about rare metals and minerals in the podcast in the past. They are, of course, crucial in the manufacture of the low-carbon technology and infrastructure necessary for decarbonisation. A big challenge is mining them without local ecosystem destruction. To find out about what the future demand for rare metals and minerals is going to look like, and some innovation in extracting them from the seafloor with significantly less harmful impacts than traditional mining methods, I spoke with CEO of the metals company, Gerard Barron. That's coming up. First, though, is some sustainable business news. The Science Based Targets Initiative has published a new report about progress on its business ambition for 1.5 Celsius programme. This was originally set up in June 2019 and ran through to October 2021, during which period companies could commit to set science-based targets and additionally commitments to net zero. The companies that committed to both had until 31st of January 2024 to establish and put them into action. The programme was designed to shift corporate focus from an ambition to limit the global rise in temperatures from 2 Celsius to 1.5 Celsius. During the time the campaign was open, just over 1,000 companies with a market capitalisation of some $23 trillion signed up for the process. The new report analyses 971 of the companies. Of these, by the end of January, 84% had set targets or were in the process of being validated. 96% of the companies rated the value of having science-based targets as good to very good. Significantly more companies set near-term 1.5 Celsius aligned targets than net zero targets, with the challenges of getting to grips with supply chain scope 3 emissions cited as the biggest barrier to setting them. The report has shown that 284 companies have had commitments removed by SBTi because the companies had not made sufficient progress. The simmering row between the European Union and parts of the palm oil sector over biofuels and renewable energy designation continues. The World Trade Organization has weighed in and found fault with how the EU would not accept palm oil as an acceptable source of renewable energy. The WTO ruled that it was indeed valid for the EU to fight against palm oil and other agriculture-based fuels because of deforestation and indirect land use change emissions risks, but that such criteria had been implemented by the EU in the case of Malaysia in a manner that constituted arbitrary or unjustifiable discrimination. One of the main points of dispute for Malaysia was the EU's use of a 10-year limit to determine crops that could or could not be deemed to have low indirect land use change risk. It was argued that this approach is more appropriate for crops that are sown and harvested in one growing season, such as rapeseed. Oil palm trees take most of a decade to reach maturity and then produce fruits, and then go on to have a 30-year lifespan. This can mean that under a life cycle assessment of emissions, palm oil has a lower emissions profile than annual crops. The EU has indicated it'll have another rethink on how to structure its rules and definitions. Some outcomes from the recent stalling of the EU's flagship Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive have been highlighted by the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre and others. The directive's language is apparently being redrafted so that SMEs will not be negatively impacted by the regulation through their relationships with larger in-scope customers. The bigger companies will be required to provide support and resources to their smaller suppliers to help them comply with due diligence and will be required to guarantee fair contractual terms. The impact on smaller companies was reportedly a central part of why some EU governments signalled intent to block the directive's progress. It remains unclear if a revised version will have a chance of being passed through the EU's approval process ahead of the European Parliament elections in the early summer. Next up is a conversation I had recently with Gerard Barron, CEO and Chair of the Metals Company. So we're talking about rare metals and minerals. They are used, of course, to manufacture much of the low-carbon technology and infrastructure that we need now and in the future. To kick us off, perhaps you can give us a bit of background as to what the current shortfalls are between identified sources and what we're likely to need.
The International Energy Agency forecasts that by 2040, we'll need to increase mined material by 5 to 600% per annum. That's across the whole category of metals. Now, some of them are more exaggerated than others. And of course, nickel and copper and cobalt, which really are at the core of what the metals company are doing, are some of those most affected. Nickel, it's forecast, its use case in batteries will go up in excess of 15 times its current demand. So the question is, the transition away from fossil fuels is really only just beginning, but it's only one of the demand drivers. The other demand drivers, of course, are the ongoing industrialization of the developing world and population growth. We're still adding to the world headcount, and that will continue until we get to around 11 billion people, up from the current 8 billion. So all of that puts enormous pressure on the supply of minerals.
Where are the sources of these minerals traditionally located?
Of course, 70% of our planet is ocean and 30% of it is land. In the case of metals, all of our metals currently come from that 30% known as land. And obviously, you know, the pioneers went and found the obvious deposits first and mined them. And you've got some amazing areas like the Rockies and the Andes that were covered in these metals and also form these tremendous mineral deposits. But in more recent times, what we're having to do is to push into more sensitive ecosystems. And I guess the best example of that are our equatorial rainforests. What we're starting to see is more activity, whether it's in the Congo, the Amazon, or whether it's in Indonesia and the Philippines, where some of the most important biodiverse rainforests exist. And unfortunately, there's a lot of metals in those areas as well. And so a lot of those ecosystems are being pushed aside so we can get access to those metals underneath them.
So who controls then the sources of these metals? You know, what are the consequences of that control?
Recently, I guess the world got a big focus on it. A, when Russia invaded the Ukraine. Secondly, when COVID interrupted supply chains. People realized that actually between Russia and China, that is the dominant supply of these materials, in particular China. China dominate the supply and the manufacture of most of the metals that we talk about. And why? It's because they've had this very forward-looking vision. They've laid out investment well ahead of the curve. And as a result, they now are the dominant supplier. And if they don't mine it themselves, they secure the materials to then process and add value to. And so today, when you think about battery materials, China is the equivalent of OPEC. They dominate world supply of these materials. For countries that are looking to build independent supply chain and independent energy systems, you've got to come up with a new supply, or you've got to be happy with the knowledge that you're totally reliant on China and Russia. And for some people, that's okay. For other people, and when it comes to national security, I think it does make sense to try and secure these raw materials. But the trouble is, what do you do? No one wants a mine in their backyard. Some of the biggest deposits in America have had their permits cancelled. And so no one wants a mine in their backyard. And it means people think, well, I can outsource that to the developing world. But unfortunately, China pretty well dominates the ownership of the developing world mining assets as well. So it's time we've got to think a little bit more laterally about where can the supply of these materials come from.
What's the consequence of the current ownership of these mines and metals? If we don't do something different, what's the consequence?
The consequence is accepting the fact that we are in China's hands when it comes to the supply of these raw materials. There's a scenario where that might just work out fine, but there's also a scenario where those countries may use the supply of those materials as economic weapons. And of course, that's not an enviable situation to be in. We've already seen it when it comes to rare earths, where China dominates the supply of those as well, and they have threatened to cut the supply in certain geopolitical situations. But it just makes more sense to control the supply of these raw materials yourselves if you have the opportunity to do so. And this also comes at a time when countries are wanting to onshore or reshore jobs as well and build industries locally, so as those supply chains, once again, can't be disrupted in the future.
You mentioned just now that no one wants a mine in their backyard. What's traditionally the impact of a rare earth metals metal mine? What's the impact like?
It's not pretty for a number of reasons. One is it has a direct impact and an indirect impact. The direct impact is that it's a pretty nasty process mining. You know, you've got to turn up a lot of dirt. And think about last year, the average grade of copper that was mined was less than half of 1%. So that means you go and dig up a ton of material. You're looking for, 1,000 kilograms of material, you're looking for 5 kilograms of copper. And that's only going to get worse. And so that means you've got to move an enormous amount of material to be able to produce a little bit of the important metals that you're looking for. But then you've also generated a lot of waste. And the question is, what do you do with that waste? And we've seen recently in Brazil where this waste is put into what are known as tailings dams. And these tailings dams have a habit of breaking, bursting. And of course, if you want to Google Brazil tailings disaster, it's all there to see. And that was an asset owned half by BHP, the world's largest mining company, and half owned by Vale, who I think were number three. So even when they're managed by very responsible companies, they can still go wrong. But of course, some operators aren't even that responsible. And so it means that some of this waste material can expand into freshwater systems. Of course, you're also competing when it comes to water. You see a lot of conflict now in places like Chile, where indigenous farmers are competing for those water rights. And one quarter last year, copper production was down 20% because of the lack of available water required. And so it has a big impact, both in a direct and an indirect sense. I'm talking about the good mines. The bad mines is where the impact is, heartbreaking, because you're talking about some of the most pristine biodiverse ecosystems on our planet, home to indigenous communities that are just being encroached by the expansion of mining. And unfortunately, to get to the metal-bearing ore, you have to remove the indigenous communities, you have to remove the rainforest and all of the topsoil and everything that lives there. Of course, you can't replace those ecosystems in several lifetimes. Biodiversity is impacted, the sequestered carbon is released back into the atmosphere. More waste is generated. And, in some cases, such as nickel laterites, you generate this waste material known as chromium 6 plus. For those people that saw the Erin Brockovich movie, that's what that was about. If these nickel laterites are exposed to weather, the runoff is poisonous. It contains lots of chromium 6 plus. And that's where it can get into rivers and oceans and impact ecosystems far beyond the direct mining area.
Clearly, very harmful or potentially harmful and disruptive as well. So, what are the alternatives then?
70% of our planet is ocean. It makes sense that the ocean will be filled with metals. And in fact, there's one particular deposit that the metals company are very focused on, which sits in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Mexico, that has a very abundant supply of what are known as polymetallic nodules. And they literally sit on the seafloor and on part of the ocean that is known as the abyssal plain. And if you think about the different ecosystems on our planet, you've got tropical rainforests at one end, which have the most life. And at the other end, you have Arctic ice, which has no living biomass in it. Right next to Arctic ice are the abyssal plains. We measure the amount of life in grams per square meter instead of around 40 kilograms per square meter when it comes to equatorial rainforests. And the reason for that is it's very deep, it's around 4,000 meters. There's no light there, of course, there are no plants. And most of the food that falls down through the water column is eaten along the way. So it's very low energy. And so they're basically just large fields of clay. It doesn't mean there's no life in there. As I mentioned, we measured the amount of life in grams per square meter. There's just not much of it. So there's not much to impact when we carry out activity in that area. These nodules are very rich in nickel and copper and cobalt and manganese. That's a perfect blend of the base metals that we're going to need billions of tons more of as we meet the future energy demands. What the metals company have been busy doing for the last 12 years is environmental studies to look at what the impact of collecting these nodules will be, obviously defining and understanding the resource. And then in 2022, we carried out a 6-month collector test where we were out there collecting our nodules off the ocean floor at commercial scale. We think it's the best alternative for a number of reasons. One of them is there's very little biomass life in the abyssal plains. So if we take it right back to first principles, it makes sense that we carry out extractive industries in parts of our planet where there is the least life, not the most life. And apart from Arctic ice, there is no environment on our planet with less life than the abyssal plains. Secondly, there are no communities that live nearby, so you don't have to relocate people who were living around this area. There's no alternative use. We can't go and grow things there, so there's no other function for it. What we're proving is that we can collect these rocks that lie unattached. Think of a golf driving range with golf balls on it. That's what this area looks like. And our job is to pick up these nodules with the least impact and the greatest efficiency. And what we're finding is that we can mitigate the impacts to the collection area. And so people in the past have been worried about the dust that we will generate. So think of it as when you drive your car down a dirt track, you generate some dust. How far does it travel? Well, the same when we drive our robot on the seafloor, we're picking up nodules and we collect some sediment and it gets spat out the back of the collector. And so there was speculation about how this sediment might travel for long distances. What we have conclusively proven is that the sediment stays very contained. It creates its own turbidity current and only rises several meters off the ocean floor, and up to 98% of it settles in the same area. So that means we can localize that impact, which is really good news. Right now, I mentioned we ran a collector test back in 2022. Well, for the last 2 months, our boat has been back out into that same area filled with scientists so we can study the recovery rates of the area that we impacted. And the results have been really encouraging. The boat is still out there now. And what we're finding is that there are high recovery rates. Even the organisms that were most heavily impacted because they were right next to a collector track are still there and thriving. And that's going to be an important part of our environmental impact assessment that we lodge with the regulator later this year. And then finally, the important benefit is when we come to shore. The average grade of copper mined last year was half of 1%. That means the other 99% is waste. Whereas with our nodules, and if I were with you, I'd hand you one, Ian, but the one I have in my hand here, we use 100% of the mass of this nodule. So we don't generate any waste or any tailings. No tailings, no waste. It's really a game changer when it comes to how we think about the mining industry. And it represents a much lower environmental and human impact compared to any alternative on land. And it's in a very tight, contained area.
Can you explain how you extract these nodules? I mean, I can't imagine it's the same as running a cart around a golf driving range.
You have to build a robot that can sustain pressure at 4,000 meters below sea level. So you put a robot, an electric robot on the seafloor. It has an umbilical cord that supplies the power. It's connected to what's known as an air riser. So we use a mixture of air and water as the transport mechanism. Basically, our robot crawls along the seafloor. We fire a jet of water at the nodule, which creates an inverse pressure and lifts the nodule. It's an engineering principle known as the Coanda effect. It means that we don't go down there and dig up the ocean floor. We crawl along, we fire a jet of water, because all of the nodules lie unattached on the seafloor, like those golf balls. And then we add compressed air into the air riser about a third of the way down, and that compressed air expands, rises, creates a vacuum. And that provides the transport mechanism to get the nodules up to our production vessel. The production vessel on a regular occurrence will offload the nodules to a transporter and the transporter brings it to shore. One of the other gifts of this resource, normally you have to build all of the infrastructure around where the ore body is. And those land-based ore bodies tend to be in pretty difficult to get places or places with very little infrastructure. So you've got to build roads and railway lines and deep water ports and power supply and places for people to live. But we don't have any of those challenges for two reasons. Our production vessel, we adapt in a shipyard and then we sail it on out there and we're in production days later. And when it comes to the onshore processing, what we have proven is that the way you process rainforest nickel through an RKEF, a rotary kernel electric furnace, is the same way that we can process our nodules. There are two benefits of that. One of them is there is a lot of RKEFs already built and permitted, and they exist in Japan, in China, and in Indonesia. An equally important benefit is that us supplying our nodules to those RKEFs means that they won't be supplied the rainforest nickel. And that's where we think we can make a really positive benefit by slowing down the future expansion of that rainforest nickel and replace it with polymetallic nodules as the feedstock. But the fact that we don't have to go and build or finance those processing plants is a real game changer, because it's hard to get capital for any mining project, let alone a new one. The fact that we don't have to really puts us at an advantage.
I would imagine that one of the principal challenges you have here, it would be establishing the rights to the seabed. It's not owned by anybody. How do you establish ownership of the bit you want to develop and get the rights of access?
People often say to me, it makes so much sense. Why hasn't it happened before? Well, 50 years ago, this industry almost started. You had BP and Shell and Mitsubishi and Sumitomo all involved in this industry in the same area where we are active. But the United Nations stepped in and stopped them, because 50 years ago, the world had not agreed who owned the oceans and where do your borders begin and end as a sovereign. But that was finally agreed when UNCLOS was signed in 1982. A sovereign owns everything within 12 miles of their coastline, and they have an economic right to everything within 200 miles of the coastline. But beyond that, it's deemed the common heritage of humankind, and it's owned by everyone. And the United Nations set up a body called the International Seabed Authority to govern these international waters. There are 168 member countries plus the European Union, so 169. And it's a really interesting regulatory framework, because you don't have any one country being able to dominate proceedings. You've got one country, one vote. So you've got all of the countries of the world overseeing the regulatory framework. We're at the final throes of agreeing what's known as the mining code. That is what will allow us to lodge our application from what we have now, which are exploration licenses, to be able to commercially extract and sell these materials. We like the fact that there is a central regulatory body that will hold all of the participants to a high standard. When you outsource mining to a developing country, you also outsource the regulatory oversight. And that's how some of these disasters can happen. Whereas at the International Seabed Authority, you've got an organization representing 169 countries who have the ability to give or withhold licenses and who have full regulatory oversight.
You mentioned UNCLOS. What is that organization?
That is the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea. And that was signed in 1982, and it was really the framework to allow the development of ocean bed resources, in particular polymetallic nodules. I sometimes hear people say the regulator is deciding whether this industry should go ahead or not. That's already been decided. What's been decided now are the final rules under which we will operate.
What stage are your experiments at now then?
We are at an advanced stage. We already have our first production vessel. We've already announced where we're going to process our first nodules. We've spent more than $400 million. We've been at it for 12 years. We are preparing to lodge our application in the second half of this year, 2024. And that means that we anticipate being ready for production by the end of 2025. It's been an exciting last few years, because we've really been able to move the boat forward. The successful collector trials in 2022 were a major milestone. You don't always expect these things to go perfectly the first time, but great respect to our partner and largest investor, Allseas, who for the last 37 years have been laying pipe in the deep ocean for the oil and gas industry. So they were able to bring all of that operational experience in the deep ocean to our new industry. And together we made a fantastic commercial trial in 2022. And so what we're busy doing now is analyzing the enormous amount of environmental data that we've collected over the last decade, because it is that environmental data that will form the most important part of our application that the regulator will then look at to say, yes, you can move forward, or we need to have a talk about this. And so far, what I can say is that the environmental evidence points to what we always believed to be true, and that is that we can absolutely mitigate the impacts. This is the right thing to be doing for our planet's future.
So what are the potential stumbling blocks for your application then? You mentioned some of them just now, but what needs to fall into place for your application to be successful?
We need to complete it, but that's on track. We have an amazing team that are all over this. The environmental results need to all come together to create a clear picture on how we're going to manage this as we then move into production. We have a production vessel, which people can see if they go to our website, metals.co, that we used for our 22 trials, 2022 trials. We're busy preparing that for a bigger production platform. So that will be able to handle up to 3 million tons of production a year. So that has some engineering work to be carried out over the next 18 months. And look, it's a busy, busy time. You know, there are lots of conversations as the environmental evidence is starting to become clearer. It's important that we share that. It's important that capitals, countries are able to see both the quantity and the quality of how we've approached this environmental research program so that we can produce reliable projections as we move forward.
So who else is involved here? Who are your backers?
We are a public company. We're listed on the NASDAQ. TMC is our ticker. Our biggest investor to date has been a company called Allseas. And so we went looking for a partner who had extensive operational knowledge in the deep ocean. We were very lucky to strike an agreement with Allseas. They've been an amazing partner. We have large family office out of San Francisco, who are our largest shareholder, who've been equally amazing supporters for other reasons. And we've got a lot of friends and family. And then we're a public company. And so we have a lot of shareholders, some of whom I know and many who I don't. But we have attracted a lot of important strategic supporters, even if they're not shareholders, because this is a new industry. It's a little bit like the analogy with offshore oil and gas. Once upon a time, there was no offshore oil and gas, and then there was. And today, 30% of that oil and gas comes offshore. In the case of these metals, I think it will be even more aggressive. But the beauty, of course, of our polymetallic nodules is that they don't come with the same associated risks that developing offshore oil and gas came with.
What's the path through to success then look like? How do you scale?
The scaling process is an exciting one because we simply have to put more production vessels on the water, and they will become even more efficient as time goes on. I think in the future, the production targets will be more than 3 million tons per vessel. The same with onshore. We have already identified partners who want to partner with us to process our nodules in existing built processing plants in Asia. One of the great opportunities, of course, as we scale, is to bring more of those materials into the Northern Hemisphere, in particular to the USA and to Northern Europe. That's something that, of course, President Biden signed some recent language in the NDAA, which was calling on the Department of Defense to carry out an urgent study to make sure that America could be in a position to take advantage of processing opportunities, our materials. We expect that to be heading in the right direction. The great opportunity for America is to work with companies like us. So even though China, big license holders alongside us, we are more advanced. We have what I would estimate a 7-year advantage over the next nearest license applicant. Markets like the USA could easily do a deal with us for us to supply some of those intermediate products, which would form the foundation for a bigger battery industry and create local jobs and secure those supply lines and help make markets like the USA mineral independent, like they successfully became energy independent last decade.
What do you see as the potential of this process? How big can it get?
I think it can become an enormous industry built on the back of commercial benefits, so better economics, but importantly, better environmental benefits as well. And I think when we move into production and we can show, as we will, the low environmental impacts that we have, then customers are going to favor ocean metals over land-based metals, because we're going to be able to measure everything down to a T. How much CO2 we generated, how much water we used in the processing, how much child labor we used, and I can guarantee there'll be none. How many human rights violations were incurred? There'll be none. How many indigenous community did we have to move aside once again? How much sequestered carbon did we impact? So we're going to be able to put Cladstein guarantees around those numbers. And I think as we move forward with carbon equalization measures and battery passports, having a lower environmental footprint is going to be really important in the future and will help differentiate our metals over alternatives. I think what that will mean is that capital will become more available to operators like us to help us fund and scale into higher production numbers. We're thinking that way at the moment. We've got to get our first production vessel busy, and that's the plan, to have that in production by the end of next year. And then it's about how do we add more scale. But my goal is to absolutely make sure that Ocean Metals from polymetallic nodules can become top 10 supplier in the case of nickel and copper and cobalt and manganese, and in three of those, be the number one supplier globally.
You brought it up, but how can you guarantee there's no forced labor at nickel processing facilities in Indonesia?
That comes down to who you partner with. I think what we're seeing, even from the time we started looking, the first deal we've announced, by the way, is in Japan with a great company there called Pacific Metals. But I think as time goes on, what we're going to see in places like Indonesia, alternative energy suppliers, primarily coming from things like geothermal, and also more focus on those human rights and labors. I have visited plants in Indonesia, and what I can tell you I see is a lot of pretty nasty mining, but a lot of happy local people with jobs who are busy processing these materials. And even the ones that I visited, which were Chinese owned, they predominantly used local labor. And so they do have a lot of local community benefits that go with it. Those issues are really important to us, but I believe they're also important to the other side as well. And we would only contract with someone who had those same values and saw the same importance that we do on those topics.
So ultimately then, the timetable for success, what does that look like from this point on? You obviously mentioned you're getting your application in. What's the process beyond that?
I think the order of events will be this. We lodge our application in the second half of this year. The International Seabed Authority bed down the final mining code the first half of next year, and we receive our permit to move forward in the second half of 2025 and start production. We have had the cart beside the horse, is the best way to describe it, Ian. We are moving forward. We've spent money on the assumption that the mining code will fall in place on time and that we'll have a permit to move into production. And we were just lucky to find people like Allseas who were willing to come with us with that same vision. They will be the three big milestones: lodge the application, mining code adopted, permit granted, and production begins. I hope we'll see all three of those before the end of 2025.
It's a very interesting process and it's certainly solving a serious problem. It's fascinating to see how it all comes together. But for now, Gerard Barron, The Metals Company, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ian.
The Innovation Forum website is as ever the place to go for all the latest analysis and interviews and all the details about our upcoming spring conference series and how to join us. We'll be back with the briefing early next week and I'll be reporting from Innovation Forum's first event of the year, our Responsible Sourcing and Ethical Trade Forum, reporting coming up in next week's podcast. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh and until next time, goodbye.